Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon to take your calls and to hear what you have on your mind that you'd like to discuss with us. Usually that means if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith and you want to bring those up for discussion, or if you have an alternate viewpoint from the host and want to bring that up for discussion, please do. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I'd be glad to talk to you. We have a line open for you. If you want to call that number now, you'll get through pretty quick. Our first caller today is Ryan from Issaquah, Washington. Ryan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey. How you doing, Steve?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you.
Hey, I got a question for you. Have you read, I think it's Passion for God. It's the A.W. Tozer biography. And I think Lyle DeWitt, I think that's the name. He wrote that. Have you read that?
I have not read that one. I read, many years ago, a biography of A.W. Tozer. That was called A.W. Tozer, 20th Century Prophet. It was written by a friend of his who had been a companion in ministry. And it was a good biography, but I haven't read a more recent one.
Okay, so this one's a little bit newer version, and I that's how I was also calling to ask you maybe your perspective on it. I clean windows, so I listen to stuff all day long on my headphones, you know. So I just finished listening to it, and it really portrays Tozer as someone who had a lack of ability to have any intimacy with his wife and children, maybe not able to have any sort of relationship. I mean, not like he wasn't there, but just, you know, he seemed a bit absent. And I didn't know if that was consistent with other biographies that had been written on him, or if that was maybe...
You know, the biography I read, I don't think brought that up, but I had learned that about him from certain other reports, including some people I've met who actually were in his church at one time when he was pastoring. And there was a feeling on the part of many that he was not connecting that well with his family, and that may be true. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I was not there. Tozer was one of those guys who was so fascinated with God that he was rather distracted by God from a lot of other normal things. Now, fortunately, he was a pastor. You know, so he could actually, for his calling and for his career, he could actually focus on God. But he may have neglected the emotional needs of his family somewhat. I don't know. I can't argue against that. I have to say that there are people in the Bible, like Samuel, who seem to have not done too well with their family either, or David, who had a heart after God. It's apparently a very difficult thing to balance those things out. I would think it was a fault if Mr. Tozer had spent so much time in private prayer that he neglected his family's needs. I would see that as a fault, but it's not a worse fault than many other people have.
Right.
His family was cared for. He supplied for his family. You know, we often think of the needs of a person in terms of their emotional and psychic needs a lot more than people used to. We're a very psychologized culture. And so we're very attuned to whether my emotional needs are being met by my wife or my husband or somebody like that. You know, and in older times, like biblical times, there just wasn't that much of a focus on that, although the Bible does say a man needs to love his wife and needs to dwell with her according to knowledge. So there's some responsibility there. But in older times, I think when people were not focused as much on emotional needs, as we call them today. Today women divorce their husbands for what they call emotional abuse.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's, what is emotional abuse? Well, someone's cruel to me. Well, that's not a good thing. People shouldn't be cruel. But, you know, enduring cruelty is something that was taken into, you know, consideration as part of living in a cruel world before. Your husband shouldn't be cruel to you and your wife shouldn't be cruel to you, but frankly, Jesus endured cruelty, and you know, I think that we've become a little wimpy in many cases and very feelings oriented. I'm sure that Tozer could have done better than he did with his wife and children. I believe he had quite a few children. I believe that they respected him and loved him, but as I understand it. But, you know, he may not have been sensitive to the idea that, hey, there's some emotional needs here, too. He may have just looked, well, I'm housing my family, I'm making sure they're fed and clothed and have everything they need, and I'm here. It's not like I've gone somewhere far away. I'm down in the basement in the boiler room praying half the day, you know, right. I mean, that's, yeah. He went to his private place of prayer a lot, but, you know, by today's standards, I'm sure that his balance between his spirituality and his social activities, especially with his family, would be considered to be not in balance.
Yeah, the author doesn't paint him as an awful man or anything, but he definitely the neglect, the relationship there, and there are even some comments made that Tozer had, you know, said to a friend that he was an incredibly lonely man and that his wife had said she was an incredibly lonely woman. It seems it's hard for me to understand a man so in tune with God, yet so not in tune with his wife. I understand what you're saying. I think maybe we are a bit soft. But and maybe, like I said, maybe it was just this author's portrayal of the whole situation, but it definitely...
No, I think people in his church got that impression, too. He was not a real outgoing guy. I think he was pretty introverted. And they say that, you know, he paid so few pastoral visits to people that once when he found that he was in the neighborhood of one of his parishioners who happened to be sick, he decided to drop in, which he rarely did drop in pastorally. And right. when the sick parishioner saw that Tozer was at the door, he said, "My God, I'm not that sick, am I?"
Yeah.
What's Tozer doing here, you know?
Right.
But Tozer was kind of an eccentric man, you know. He never owned a car, never got a driver's license, and someone in the church drove him around all the time. But he spent a lot of time praying. He was a very prayerful man. I mean, there were others before him, E.M. Bounds, Wesley, people like that. Wesley's marriage was not exactly a good one either. You know, Wesley's wife used to drag him around the house by the hair, and she was a very, they had a really, a tumultuous marriage, I should say, but they, you know, I think that we live in a time where a man's duties, his spiritual duties to his family, are more emphasized in Christian teaching than they were a couple generations ago. And Wesley, I'm sure, thought that although his relationship with his wife was a disaster, that he was serving God because a lot of people were getting saved. And I'm sure that Samuel felt that because he was going around preaching in these various centers where the sons of the prophets were, that the fact that his kids were rotten, evil men, well, that's just the cross he had to bear, so to speak. You know, he was serving God. And Tozer probably had that attitude. I can't answer for him whether he did. I did hear from somebody who had talked to Tozer's widow after he was dead. And she remarried, and reportedly, this person who was talking to me said that she asked Tozer's widow, "Wow, how could you, after being married to such a man as A.W. Tozer, how could you ever, you know, get married again? I mean, the bar is so high. How could you find a husband you'd be happy with?" And Tozer's widow reportedly said, "Well, Mr. Tozer really loved God.
Yeah.
But my present husband really loves me."
Yep. Yeah. Says that in this book too. Same quote taken in this book. And,
is it? Yeah.
Yeah. It just alludes to her.
It's very sad. And when I heard that reported, it kind of stabbed me in the heart because I'm a great Tozer fan. But it warns us. It warns us. You know, those of us in ministry, we can love God, but we better make sure that people around us know we love them too.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then, I just wanted to hear your take on it. That makes sense. And I feel the same way. I feel like it must have been one of his blind spots, or just one of the things he just wasn't able to overcome. I definitely sat in my heart. I really enjoyed listening to the audiobook, but it definitely left me with a bit of a somber tone at the end, you know?
Well, you know, a lot of times you read about these heroes who did great things for God, and you read their biographies and say, "What? You know, how could he have that going on?" You know, it's not like they had some kind of scandalous sin in their life. But there's some area that we would think would be an obvious area of neglect. Okay. But again, we have to remember that let me put it this way. People wonder how John Calvin could have authorized the burning of a man he disagreed with theologically, Michael Servetus, burning him at the stake. We think, what? How could a Christian ever take that position? Well, I don't know. I can't see how a Christian could take that position. But I do know this, that Calvin was living in the early days of the Reformation. He was a Catholic priest before he was Reformed. And the Catholic Church had for thousands of years been burning heretics. In other words, burning of heretics is something that was considered to be normal.
Right.
And now, no one in our day would think burning heretics is normal. In fact, if a Christian did it, we'd think they were absolutely demonic. And I don't know, maybe we'd be right. But it was certainly, we can say it certainly was a blind spot that we don't have anymore. And I think if you go back a few generations, a lot of ministers did neglect their families somewhat. And it wasn't something that was preached against as much as is now. I mean, there's a very strong emphasis in our generation and the previous generation now for the need for spirituality to be lived out in the home. And for, if you love God, show it by loving your wife and your kids. And I'm sure Tozer was very concerned about the well-being of his wife and kids. I'm sure it would have been, I'm sure it was a high priority that they should serve God and love God too. But he may have been a little out of touch with how things were going in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I definitely pull away from it. His prayer life was inspiring, and it definitely reminds me just to keep my eye and my heart close to my family. So it's not I didn't come away from it, feeling bad, I guess, or, you know, whatever, upset or disappointed in Tozer or whatever. I know he's just a man, but I didn't know that about him, so it was interesting to hear. But he's still super inspiring. I love
him. Yeah, it takes him down a few notches, but he's still a better man than me.
Yeah, me too. So that's good. I just wanted to hear your take on it, and I appreciate you helping me out, and I'm going to go back to cleaning glass. I know you used to do that, so...
I did. You know, when you told me that you wash windows and you listen to... That's how I became a Bible teacher, really. I was a window washer.
Yeah.
I was just a Christian window washer. But I would listen to the Bible or to sermons or Bible studies while I washed windows and got into my head.
Yeah, that's all I do for, 8 hours a day. I don't think I quite have the memory that you have, so it kind of goes in and goes out sometimes, but it's a good way to spend the day. So.
Yeah, well, you know what? I don't have the memory I have either. Honestly, I honestly think it's a gift. My natural memory is not impressive. About most things. But when it comes to memory scripture, I believe that's just something God gave me. I can't take credit for that. Anyway,
yeah,
brother.
I agree. It's a gift from God, and I appreciate that he gave it to you. So anyway, thanks for helping me out, and I hope you have a good day.
Okay, bro. Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, Ron from West Hills, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I guess once upon a time, leaders of Israel used to be shepherds, to be leaders. Now I guess they have to be window washers, and this is a general.
Yeah, I guess so.
To know the Word of God really well. My question today is regarding binding or normative laws, and I'm going to refer to one scripture and then ask two questions that I think you can answer both together.
Okay.
In Matthew 15:4, Jesus is talking about, it's in regard to the Korban law, I guess. It says here, God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curses father and mother, let him die the death. And, of course, that second part of the verse is in Leviticus 29 and Exodus 21:17 about cursing your father and mother and being death. Now, at the time Jesus was, talking to the Jews here, this law would still have been binding upon them, right, if he's bringing it up. This is one of the few examples.
Right. That's right.
Okay, so when he died, and this will be my general question above that one, he did away with the ceremonial law because we lost the sacrifices and the temple and many of the things, the washings and so forth. So many of those laws kind of went out of the way. God had a period of grace between the death of Jesus and the destruction of the temple to allow the Jews to come to him, but eventually he had to take that whole system out of the way. So we know those laws have been kind of superseded by what Christ did.
Right.
But what about these laws for the Jews?
We call those civil laws. Those are civil laws. Yeah.
Now, would this be still not in our nation? But of course, in Israel, fortunately, is not a religious nation; it's a secular nation. But they could enact a law like this just from cursing your father and mother. They could put people to death, right? Children, right?
That is correct. Let me say this. They could have then. I want to say this. I don't think Israel now can legitimately go back to the old arrangement. You know, the laws that God gave through Moses were suited to the old arrangement, the old covenant.
Okay.
Israel was God's people. They were a political and civil state as well as a religious community. In that respect, they are not like any other nation on earth. Every nation is political, but no nation is a covenant worshiping community. Only Israel was. And therefore, the laws that God gave Israel, a lot of them were special to that calling. Now, Israel today doesn't have the option of going back and saying, we're going to go back and live by those laws. I mean, they can do it, but God won't honor it. I don't think God would honor today putting to death a child who cursed his parents. That was, I think, an important part of maintaining the holiness of the nation when it was God's holy people. The nation of Israel today is not God's holy people anymore. They reject Christ in general. Many of them don't even believe in God at all, and they are not existing in a covenant relationship with God. Therefore, the laws associated with their covenant relationship with God would not automatically, you know, apply across the board. Some laws that God gave them obviously are universal laws about, you know, murder and theft and things like that. I mean, all governments that care about justice are going to outlaw certain things like theft and murder and other criminal actions that victimize other people. And the modern state of Israel should do that too, because every nation should do that. But when it comes to special laws that tied especially to their covenant status, then I don't think modern Israel has the right to go back and do that again. Today, if you started stoning children because they cursed their parents, I think there'd be an international outcry.
Yes, I believe that. Yeah.
Back then, it wouldn't have been an international outcry because their laws were much more merciful than those of the surrounding nations around them. But the world today has been civilized to a very large degree by the gospel. That's not the main influence the gospel is supposed to have, but it is one influence the gospel has. It civilizes societies. And so even people who are not Christians often think a lot more like Christians than people did in the pre-Christian world, because Christianity has elevated the moral sensitivities of the society. That's how the leaven leavens the lump. And therefore, I think it's Christian values that would forbid us to stone our children in that way.
Well, Steve, what about, I don't think these would apply either. Putting adulterers to death or even homosexuals to death, because the way the world is going now, obviously those things are no longer death penalties, except maybe in a few nations in Africa or something. But we don't do that. But in God's eyes, those are death sentences, as far as if someone died in the state of having been an adulterer or homosexual or some of these other sins that had the death penalty here physically, they still are facing a death penalty with God in the afterlife, right?
Well, sure. I mean, anyone who dies with sin on their conscience and unforgiven, whether it's one of those capital crimes or not, faces the penalty of death.
Yeah. We just don't do it now in the physical, because our nations have, they don't follow the laws of God anyway, not even Israel anymore.
Well, that's just it. See, Israel was a civil state that had to maintain a criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. The church doesn't maintain a criminal justice system in that sense. We do in a sense. We're supposed to have church discipline, and we do. We are supposed to exclude. This is the biggest punishment. The biggest punishment the church can inflict on its members is basically it's the exclusion of them from the fellowship.
Expulsion from the church, yeah.
Right. But a political nation does make enforceable civil laws, and their criminal justice system is going to have certain penalties attached. The church doesn't penalize people except by expulsion or exclusion, but the state does have other penalties. Now, that's one reason why those laws about putting people to death like that are not practiced today. Because, first of all, the Jewish state ceased to exist, and therefore those laws would no longer govern it. The Christians, the church, we don't kill people. That's not our business. And so it remains for the secular nations to decide how they will punish certain crimes. And very few of them have adopted the Jewish code from Moses.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Steve. God bless you.
All right, Ron. Good talking to you. Thanks for your call.
Okay.
Bye now. All right. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can reach me. We have one line open right now at 1-800-438-5090. We got a call from Albany, Oregon. Philip, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. I just have a very short question. It's, many times I hear that Jewish believers like to quote so much better from the Hebrew scriptures and exchange it in the New Testament for Hebrew instead of Greek, and it always seems to be more favorable to the Hebrew understanding. Why was the New Testament written in Greek then when it's supposed to be more accurate in Greek or equal?
Well, the Bible certainly does not indicate that the Hebrew language is a superior language. It just happened to be the language that God's people were speaking when he gave them books to read. So he wrote them in their language, Hebrew. Later, when the New Testament was written, the Hebrew language was no longer spoken. In Palestine, the Jewish people spoke Aramaic, but they also spoke Greek. Everybody spoke Greek because Alexander the Great had conquered the world 300 years earlier and had imposed Greek as the universal language throughout his empire, and that included Israel. So the Jews and everybody else for 300 years had been speaking Greek, but they also, all nations also had their own local dialects. For the Jews, that was Aramaic. And so when the New Testament was written, it was always written in the language of the people that it was addressing. And most of the New Testament was written to Gentiles. I mean, the books that Paul wrote, three of the four Gospels, were written to Gentiles. And it would be, the only sensible thing is to be writing Greek. That's the language they all knew. Now, Matthew's first draft was apparently written in Aramaic. According to Papias, an early church father, he said that Matthew first wrote the sayings of Jesus in Aramaic, but they were later translated into Greek and expanded on, apparently, so that our Gospel of Matthew, as we have it today, was probably originally in Greek, but incorporated a Greek translation of some things that Matthew had written earlier in Aramaic. But for the most part, there's no evidence that the other New Testament books ever had an Aramaic or a Hebrew original. Certainly Paul never wrote to the Corinthians in Aramaic. What would be the point of that? They're Greeks. They don't know Aramaic. He didn't write to the Romans in Aramaic. But I want to say this, Phil. You are in Albany, Oregon, and near where you are, in Salem, Oregon, there's a radio station that has, as I understand, been turned entirely over to the Hebrew Roots Movement.
Exactly. That's where I get a lot of my questions from.
Them. Yeah. Well, the Hebrew Roots Movement.
I don't understand is if Hebrew would be superior to Greek, why would God have wanted it, the meaning of his son's word to be given in Greek rather than Hebrew, if Hebrew is more accurate to God's own way of speaking?
I don't think Hebrew is as exact as Greek. For example, some of the verb tenses that are differentiated in Greek are not differentiated in Hebrew. So that, for example, you'd have the same word in Hebrew for a past tense or for a past perfect tense. Now, past tense and past perfect are not communicating exactly the same thing, but they would be in the same form in Hebrew because there's not a separate past perfect tense. There is in Greek. And so in a sense, Greek is more exact than Hebrew. There's nothing more superior about Hebrew. But you see, the Hebrew Roots Movement, you have to understand their mentality. They don't have really proof or evidence for their special claims. They have sentiment. There's a certain mood, a certain sentiment that many Christians have that since the Jews were God's chosen people in the Old Testament, since Jesus was Jewish and the apostles were Jewish, somehow that means Jewish is best. You know, the prophets and Moses were Jewish, and therefore everything Jewish is better.
Yes.
And that would include the language, Hebrew.
Especially if it's something that seems to put them over on Greek. If they think they have a better interpretation of what Christ or the apostles meant, and it suits more to their interpretation of the scriptures in Hebrew, then they put down the Greek interpretation, saying it's not as valid or it's not as good, it's not as original as what God really meant or what Jesus really meant.
I understand.
Yeah,
I understand. Well, the Hebrew roots people often think that the New Testament was written originally in Aramaic and that it was translated into Greek. And it is true that there are some Aramaic manuscripts of the New Testament that go back pretty far, but not further than the Greek ones. The evidence is, of course, that much of the New Testament, well, virtually all of it, was written in Greek. There was a theory held by Clement of Alexandria that the book of Hebrews was written in Aramaic by Paul and that Luke translated into Greek. But that theory isn't a good theory because the book of Hebrews uses plays on words that only work in Greek. When, for example, the reference to a covenant, diatheke, in Greek can mean covenant or testament, meaning a will, and not so in Hebrew. And yet, the book of Hebrews, the writer makes a play on words in chapter 9 using that word for both covenant and a will. And he makes it's strictly a play on words that works in Greek. It would never work in Aramaic. So Paul, if he wrote in Aramaic, would not have made that argument.
But if Jesus, during the time of Jesus and the apostles, did Jesus talk to the disciples in Greek or in Hebrew? And did the disciples talk among to each other in Hebrew or Greek?
Probably Aramaic, which is closer to Hebrew. The local dialect that they spoke was probably Aramaic, though they were quite fluent in Greek also, as everybody was.
But if they would be among themselves, what would motivate them more to speak in an official language or the language they grew up on, or so to say?
Yeah, I think they were raised knowing both languages, but there's some evidence in the New Testament that they spoke Aramaic. Once in a while, we have Jesus' own Aramaic words preserved, even in the Greek New Testament. Sometimes the Greek writers actually left Jesus' statements in the original, like Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, or Talitha kumi, or, certain words like that, amen, amen, these are Aramaic terms, and they preserve Jesus' original statements in Aramaic. But what we have to understand is Jesus and the disciples were probably accustomed to speaking Aramaic among themselves. That was the language of their day. But the Gospels were written at a later date when the Gospel had now gone out to the Gentile world, and three of the Gospels, at least, were written for Gentile readers, which means that if the message of Jesus and his conversations with the disciples and so forth are to be recorded for Gentile readers, instead of giving them in Aramaic, they'll have to be written in the language people know. And so when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, especially Mark, Luke, and John, wrote their Gospels, they translated what they had heard Jesus say or what someone had heard Jesus say in Aramaic. They wrote their Gospels in Greek, so they translated them into Greek.
So the meaning is then that it doesn't matter if you read the Gospels in Greek or in Hebrew, you get the full value out of either interpretation, either speaking, right?
Right, right. Anyone who says that you have to read it in Hebrew is simply sentimental toward all things Jewish. And that's the way a lot of Christians are now. I think some Christians are maybe they're on a guilt trip over how Jews have been mistreated by professing Christians. And sometimes in the past, there's been a lot of anti-Semitism in Christian history. And I think there's sort of a pendulum swing back. Well, we need to recognize that the Jews are not Christ killers. They are the very race that Christ and the apostles were. And so I say they, but I would include myself at an earlier time in my life. back when I was a dispensationalist, I was enamored with all things Jewish. I wore a Star of David with a cross in it. I wanted to marry a Jewish girl so my children would be Jewish. That was really true when I was a teenager. I was fond of all things Jewish because that's what dispensationalism kind of does to you. And once you're there, that's reinforced in your mind by the fact that Jesus was Jewish and that the apostles were Jewish and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, and Joshua, and David, and all those guys were Jewish, and the prophets. I mean, hey, that's a very favored race there. They've had a lot of the greatest people God ever sent to the earth, sent to them.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that they were that all things Jewish are to be preferred over all things not Jewish. I think that both the Old Testament and the New make it clear that God's not a racist. God is not a xenophobe. He doesn't support one culture over another just because it belongs to a certain people.
It's just, culture-wise, I'm not that worried about it. I just want to know that when I read the words of Christ and of the apostles, I get the accurate meaning, whether it's in Hebrew or if it's in Greek. Not that one, neither that Greek is more accurate than Hebrew.
Yeah. Well,
should be the same, right?
Yeah, it should be. It should be. Now, you can still buy an Aramaic New Testament, of course. The Lamza New Testament is from Aramaic. But it's not necessarily closer to the original. You might think, well, Jesus spoke Aramaic, so the Aramaic New Testament is going to be closer. But the Aramaic New Testament was translated from the Greek New Testament.
Yeah.
So what you've got is Jesus spoke in Aramaic, probably. When the apostles wrote the Gospels, they wrote them in Greek, translating him into Greek. And the Aramaic translates from the Greek back into Aramaic, but whether it gets the same words Jesus used or not, we don't know. So, I mean, the disciples.
But the meaning is the same.
Well, the disciples apparently thought so. The disciples, the ones who wrote the Gospels, apparently thought that the way they put it in Greek was essentially equal to what Jesus actually said in his original language. And that should be good enough for me, too, then.
Yes. I just want to make sure that, we all want to understand Christ's words more perfect. So we can have a better way of worshiping or understanding him. It's just when one group says, oh, no, you don't get the correct understanding of what Christ meant. You know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. And that particular group, I do not trust the integrity of their scholarship or even necessarily of their motivations.
They're very nice people.
I'm sure they are. I know some of them. Yeah. I just believe that they're on a trip.
Okay.
What I think.
No, that means a lot to me. Thank you very much, because whether Hebrew or whether Greek, the meaning means the same.
I think so, too.
That's the important thing. Okay, thank you, Steve.
Okay, Philip. God bless you. Thank you for your call.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye now. All right, Chris from Portland, Oregon is next. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I've been listening to you a lot online, and I have actually two questions. I have a new interest in studying early church history around the time of Jesus, and I look online and I see a lot of books. I would like to read the early historians. I see a lot of books by a lot of authors. I just wondered if you would recommend one over another.
Well, I have a lot of books on church history, and I've read a lot of books on church history. I don't know if one shines above all others. One that's very popular among people just delving into the subject of church history, maybe for the first time, is one called Church History in Plain Language.
Okay.
And I think the author's name, I'm not positive, I think his name is Bruce Shelley.
Okay.
Okay. And it's called Church History in Plain Language. I'm not saying it's a better book than others out there, but it is readable, and it's basically he's a church history professor, but he's definitely writing a book for people who are new to the subject. So that would be a good start. After that, you can go deeper if you want to. You might want to pick up a book called The Apostolic Fathers.
Okay.
The Apostolic Fathers is actually a collection of writings of the early fathers, and it will include probably the Epistle of Barnabas and the Shepherd of Hermas and the Didache and probably First Clement, Polycarp, the martyrdom of Polycarp. It depends. I mean, a lot of the early writings of the church that have survived are gathered together in collections, and they usually call the collection the Apostolic Fathers. If you really get into it, you can buy the whole Church Fathers sets, like, I don't know what it is, 36 volumes or something like that. You can buy from ChristianBook.com at a pretty good reduction of the overall retail price. But anyway, you can go all kinds of ways. If you want to go further than Bruce Shelley's book, there's Lateret. Kenneth Lateret has written, I think it's a two-volume church history. Kenneth Scott Lateret is his name, as I recall.
Okay.
And there's many others that write church histories for popular consumption.
Have you heard of a book, A History of the Jewish People in the Time of Jesus by Emil Schurer?
I don't think I have that book on my shelf. I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
That doesn't mean it's not a good book.
Yeah.
It could be.
Well, thank you for those suggestions. My other question was, you know, I really struggled when I first started listening to you and going through Revelation. But
I think I give people a lot of anxiety. That's why we have the calm whistling at the beginning, to set their minds at ease.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah. I even had a time where I thought, no, I'm not going to listen to him anymore. But then I drifted back, and I really, after going through it all, you can't deny, you prove with the Bible what you believe.
I try.
And when I go back and hear what would have been my side, or the dispensationalist side was teaching, you know, they are just throwing things in, like the gaps. And
a lot of speculation there, yeah.
A lot of speculation. Mm-hmm. I heard you tell a few weeks ago, I think it was, I heard you tell about a man, I think it was a minister in a church, that was shown, I think somebody brought you to his attention, and he listened to your all millennialist view.
Yeah.
And he had to admit that after listening to it all, that he agreed with it. But, you know, he had been in this denomination for all these years and, you know, can't really go back on that now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a sin now for someone like that to teach that view when he knows it, when he believes now that it's not the right view?
I personally think that the highest value for anyone who teaches should be a love of the truth. And it would be very hard, if you really love the truth, to consciously be ignoring a certain view that seems to be true, for the simple reason that if you embraced it, you'd lose your job. You know, I mean, I can understand why that would be a crisis. I could see why somebody, you know, has a career and they say, wow, but if my views go this direction, I'll be looking for another job. And I've got kids in school. I've got a wife. I've got a mortgage. What in the heck am I going to do if I get fired from this pastorate? And I think that, I understand that. But I think that being a Christian calls you to a little more courageous action than that. And if you do suspect something is true, and you don't look at it because you don't want to believe it's true, I would just say that would strongly suggest that you don't love the truth. You love your security. You love your job. You love your money. You love something more than the truth, because you suspect that the truth lies elsewhere than what you're representing, but you don't want to find out,
right?
Because it costs you too much. That was a case of, in that case, I won't mention the denomination, but it was a dispensational denomination. And I heard only the report of that. A friend of mine who was working at our school gave my tapes at the time to this pastor and got that response when he said, well, did you listen to Steve's tapes? I said, yeah, it sounds like it's right to me, but I can't. I'm in this denomination. I have to sign every couple of years that I still am a dispensation, so I can't. You know, I'd lose my pastorate. So he wouldn't go there. Another pastor of another denomination that's dispensational, I lent him personally, because I had a relationship with him, I lent him my tapes on Israel, which are, of course, all millennial. And he listened to them, and I called him back like a week later or something, said, have you heard those tapes? I wasn't sure if he'd had time. He says, yeah, I'm going through them a second time. And and I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, and he kind of laughed. And he says, I know there's something wrong with it. I know there's got to be something wrong with it. I just can't find what it is, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes, now he's still a dispensationalist too. He might even be listening right now. I don't know. But the truth is, I knew a man who had changed and become amillennial, and yet he was a pastor in a dispensational denomination, and he simply had to keep his views close to his chest. He wasn't going to teach what he didn't believe was true, but he could withhold comment on things he felt at certain points. But he only managed to do that for about 5 years, and he just said he couldn't do it anymore. There were too many things he couldn't teach. So he had to leave that pastor. And that's a scary thing.
Yeah, it is. I actually heard somebody today. I was listening to his teaching on Revelation, and he brought up, well, there's a view out there that this is talking about the destruction of, you know, Jerusalem in 70 AD, but here's why it's not. And I thought, so he has heard the view.
Yeah, but he's persuaded that it's not true, and that's fine. Uh-huh. You know, if a man is persuaded that, preterism is not true, then he can continue to teach his view with integrity. The problem is if he suspects that preterism is true, but can't go there because it'd be death to him professionally. That's when you can't maintain your integrity like that.
Yes. And that's the thing right there. I mean, I would love to find or love to hear and see the proof that what they're saying is right, but, you know, I'm not seeing it. I'm definitely seeing it when I'm listening to you, but I'm not seeing it when I'm listening to them.
Well, you know, I give my lectures not necessarily to be persuasive, but just to be as honest as I can and give this is the way my journey went. You know, I was a dispensationalist.
Yeah.
And then my boat was rocked, you know, when I saw this verse over here or that verse over there, and I had to start thinking outside my box, and then there's another verse over there, and eventually there are a whole bunch of verses, and eventually I had to reconsider the whole paradigm, you know, but I don't really like to do that to anyone else. I honestly don't. I'd be very happy if a dispensational pastor, in his integrity, could teach his dispensationalism for the rest of his life and keep his ministry going. I'm not interested in shaking anyone up, but I am interested in telling what I think is true. And if what I say happens to be persuasive, then it does cause problems for some people.
Yeah, it does. But oh well. Like you said, if you want the truth.
So, you got to love the truth more than anything else. Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you for all that you do. I appreciate it.
Okay. I appreciate talking to you. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Ray from Las Vegas is next. Ray, good to hear from you.
Hey, good afternoon, Steve. How are you?
Good.
Good. I've got a comment. I was listening yesterday to your broadcast, and towards the end you had a very nice conversation with a very nice lady. I think it was the next to the last listener, maybe, or very close to it anyway. You were explaining to her about, I guess some of her thought was, how do we really know that Christ was the Christ?
He
was. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the last thing she, and I, this is where my comment is, you know, she made a question, and it was a very sincere question. She says, well, you know, I sure wish that Christ had shown himself. Why did Christ not show himself to the Jewish people after the resurrection? Because, you know, you talked about that. And I got to thinking, well, you know, actually, in my mind, I was saying, you know, he actually did. He showed himself to the disciples and to some others, and they were very, very Jewish.
I think her question was, why didn't he show himself to the skeptics?
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't pick that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was the Jewish people who rejected him and turned him over to Pilate. Mm-hmm. But I don't think she was thinking about racially. Of course, the disciples were Jewish. So Jesus was Jewish. His disciples were Jewish. So clearly the people he showed himself to were all Jewish. But the majority of the Jewish people were the skeptics who were not his disciples. I think her concern was, why didn't he reveal himself to them?
After the resurrection, is that where she was going?
Yeah, that's what she means. Yeah, after the resurrection. Yeah.
Okay, well then I misunderstood because I'm thinking, I've done a lot of study. Actually, I'm getting ready to begin my master's in theology.
Oh, great, good.
But that's it. I won't take up any more of your time. So
that's a good call. Thanks, Ray, for calling us.
All right, thank you. Bye bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, our next caller is Fred from Las Vegas, Nevada. Fred, good to hear from you.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
Good.
I was listening. I got to agree with you. There is a lot of poor, goofy scholarship in the Hebrew Roots movement.
Uh-huh.
And also in the Christian movement and every other movement out there.
True.
But in the discussion today, Paul in the New Testament says that he had to speak to a crowd of people in Hebrew because that's the language they spoke.
That was the language they were respected, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, that they spoke. He said, I had to speak to them in their own language, Hebrew.
Right.
And then when Jesus spoke to Paul on the road to Damascus, when he unhorsed him, he spoke to him in Hebrew. And then I'm trying to think of the guy. He translated between the Romans and the Temple Mount, because the people in the Temple Mount didn't speak Greek, and he had to translate the Hebrew and the Greek back and forth. So it's like in America we have third and fourth generations of Spanish-speaking people who in their homes and in their worship and things like that retain their language. And I'm not saying one is more superior to any other, but, I had one guy tell me that Hebrew was totally a dead language. It was never spoken during Christ's time. And I'm going, well, the Bible itself says it was spoken. And the church fathers.
Yeah. Well, all the scholars I've heard address that say that when the Greek word in the New Testament, Hebrew, when it talks about the Hebrew language, they say it's referring to the Aramaic language. Now, I don't know why they conclude that. And I don't know enough about the Greek to say, but at least I would just say all the commentators say that the Hebrew language, when it's mentioned by that term in the New Testament, is referring to the Aramaic. Now, I can't defend that because
I don't know why they would say that either, but unless it's more holdover of the the sentiment against anything Hebraic coming into Christianity, because that was...
Well, Fred, I think what it is I think it's established from archaeology that Aramaic in the last two or three centuries, or four centuries before Christ, Aramaic began to displace Hebrew as the language. It was a variation of it. Aramaic and Hebrew are very close.
They're very close because I've got the new, there's a really good, what I think is a very good translation of the New Testament from the Aramaic scrolls, which I enjoy. But this argument over Hebrew's better or Greek's better. You know what? That's why we have the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And that's why we have the Word of God. And these are the things that Paul, the great apostle, talks about. He says these dissensions over words and factions and things like that. I don't see where these things bring unity to the body. And if I want to worship with a tallit and you don't want to, what is that to me?
Mm-hmm.
And you're my brother in the Lord.
Right.
I'm going to respect your form of worship, and you're absolutely right. I've been reading and studying almost all my life, at least for the last 32 years.
Uh-huh.
And I've read thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of Jewish stuff and Christian stuff and commentary and all of that, and it's almost like Rodney King today. Why don't we just all get along? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I gotta say, when you hit that right on the nail, there is so much bad scholarship out there in every school of theological thought. That's why we have 38,000 to 42,000 different denominations.
Why can't we just get along? I think Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 3 that a divisive nature is the flesh. They have a carnal desire to divide from others. And the reason is, I think, is just pride, frankly.
Human nature.
how can I think I'm better than you unless I can find some measure by which I'm better than you? The easiest measure for me to feel better than you is that my opinions are better than your opinions.
Because I've accumulated some more knowledge than somebody else has, I should lord over them. That's exactly what Jesus and the apostles said. Don't do that. So the pagans, the Gentiles, those outside the covenant, they lord over one another. Don't you do it too?
Yeah. Amen.
So I'm with you, brother. I really get so it's hurtful. It destroys the integrity of the Word of God when we just beat each other up with it.
I hear you. I hear you, Fred. Hey, I've got one more call and only 2 minutes left.
All right. God bless you, brother. Take care.
God bless you, Fred. Bye now. Good talking to you. Okay, Kamau from Napa, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Yes, I know you're coming up at the end of your show, and I'm going to keep it very brief. I wanted to touch on a couple callers earlier about the whole dispensation issue, you know, with regarding, the pre-trib, and I know you have the amillennialism view. My thing is, for years, I hear a lot of scholars, even commentaries as well as hermeneutics, teach that the Bible teaches the pre-trib view, you know, especially when you look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, you know, verse 13 through 18, you know, which, you know, a lot of scholars go off that. So my thing is, why do a lot of pastors for years have taught on this? And, you know, verse, I see you have a different view, amillennialism view, and I just wanted your comment on that, and I'll call another time. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call. Well, first of all, people say that the Bible teaches the pre-trib view. I guess my question is, where? Where does it teach that? Now, I know the scriptures that they use, because I used them too. I had a whole, arsenal of scriptures to prove my pre-tribulation rapture doctrine when I held it. The problem is the verses I used, once I started looking at them more objectively, I'd say, well, they don't actually teach that. None of them teach it. There's no place in the Bible that says there's a pre-trib rapture. You have to extrapolate from certain things. Now, sometimes extrapolation is good. That's how we reach certain theological conclusions about lots of things. Trinity, for example. The Trinity isn't mentioned by name in the Bible, and yet we do extrapolate it from certain data. Some people do that for the pre-trib rapture. I would say this, that you mentioned 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. It's the main passage about the rapture. It doesn't say anything about pre-tribulation rapture there. There's no mention of the tribulation. There's just a mention of Jesus coming back and raising the dead and rapturing the church. Well, I think all Christians believe in that, with the exception maybe of full preterists, which are fringe theologians, I think. But virtually all Christian theologies see there's a rapture and a resurrection, and they believe 1 Thessalonians 4 is true. It's just that there's no mention of a pre-tribulation rapture there. There's just a mention of a rapture. The difference between a rapture and a pre-tribulation rapture is the question of how it fits chronologically with the tribulation. And so we need verses that don't just mention the rapture, but somehow mention it in connection with the tribulation and tells us something about its chronological relationship. I think we can find those, but they don't teach a pre-trib rapture when you find them. And we can talk about that another time. Not today. We're out of time. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's exactly how we continue to stay on the air. If you want to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or our website can help you out there, too. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.